Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Steven Siegel, your host, and today we'll be joined by Professor Andrea Petto. Welcome to our podcast today.
Hi, Steven. Thank you very much for the invitation.
So I'm very pleased and honored today to be interviewing Professor Petto. She's the author of many, many books, which our listeners will already be familiar with. Today, we'll be talking about her new book out with Palgrave. It's called The Women of the Arrow Cross Party: Invisible Hungarian Perpetrators in the Second World War, published by Palgrave Press in 2020. A little bit about Professor Petto for our listening audience. So she was born in 1964, and she's the professor in the Department of Gender Studies at Central European University, now in Vienna. Professor Petto is a doctor of science of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, and she's now teaching courses on European comparative social and gender history, her area of expertise, as well as gender and politics, women's movements, qualitative methods, oral history, and the Holocaust. Her works have been published in 23 languages. Just to mention a couple of her recent awards, there are so many. In 2005, she was awarded the Officer's Cross Order of Merit of the Republic of Hungary, by the President of the Hungarian Republic, and the Bolyai Prize by the Hungarian Academy of Sciences in 2006. Recently in 2018, Professor Petto was awarded the 2018 All-European Academy's Madame de Staël Prize for Cultural Values. And she is today in Stockholm, Sweden at Södertörn University, Doctor Honoris Causa of that university. So I'll just start with a general question about the book for you. In reading this, I'm absolutely struck by the innovation you have. And the point, I'm not sure if it's the main argument, but it's a really big point that feminist historians make in covering not just women who are icons, but women, in your case, in this book, who are war criminals. So I would like to kind of start with that topic and ask you about the main arguments for the book and why you wrote it. What brought you to this topic?
Thank you very much for the question and also for the invitation. I'm a big fan of this New Books Network. I mean, I'm getting my reading recommendations often from there. And the history of the book goes back to 2000. For the first Fidesz government, the Hungarian conservative government, when suddenly lots of women NGOs showed up and lots of women in politics. And that was the time when there was a new subculture of conservative women's NGOs came to being. And I was just wondering that why is this the case, that those women who are working in the human rights framework, they are marginal, no more than, we are talking about no more than 100 people, and suddenly there is this flourishing subculture. And then I wrote a book about this phenomenon about the conservative and far-right women, interviewing them, asking them about Why did they join the politics? What were the motivations? What were their agenda? What was their family background? And then I mean, this sounds horribly pretentious, but I was actually forecasting this illiberal term as far as women's politics is concerned. And when I was sitting in this living room, and I would like to use this opportunity to thank these women for their trust. And this was a wide range of women, starting from neo-Nazis to kind of liberal conservatives who are who opened up for me and helped me to write this book. And I'm very grateful for their trust. I felt that I'm back in time very often, that I'm sitting there in 1938 or 40. And I was wondering what happened. What happened during the Second World War and after the lustration and the justice process after the Second World War, because this seemed to be non-existing for these women. So then I started to work on the history of the People's Tribunals after this was a special institution set up after 1945, following the Soviet example, which dealt with the war criminals and the crimes committed by Hungarian perpetrators. And I was looking for the women there. So, and how this special institution dealt with the women. And then I was looking for the different institutions which were expected to make the difference after the Second World War, because these women whom I had the privilege to interview, they seemed to be totally ignoring what happened between 1944 and 1989. They only presented themselves as victims of communism, no matter that some of them actually were coming from pretty well-off families who were having not much difficulties during communism. So that's when I started to.
Right. Yeah. And I am very curious about the Arrow Cross movement, which you describe under the Horthy regime, but you describe how it was denied official recognition. And so what were some of the, first of all, what is it for our listeners? And then secondly, what were some of the challenges or obstacles you faced in interviewing it as you decided to go through sources and then examine some of the secondary literature as you do in the book?
So the Arrow Cross Party is the Hungarian Nazi Party or Fascist Party, but it's the comparison is not really the Nazi Party, but the Fascist Party, but rather the Republic of Salo in Italy. This was formed as a kind of conglomerate of several far-right groups, and it got the power after the failed attempt of Admiral Horthy to sign an armistice with the Allied forces in on the 15th of October 1944. And Hungary was occupied by the Nazi German forces on the 19th of March 1944, and this period of the German occupation was the very tragic period of the Hungarian history, and then the Arrow Cross rule became even more tragic this period, and the country was liberated by the Red Army around at the early April 1945. So that's basically the timeline. And why? I mean, the key question is for this book is the issue of invisibility. So what makes these women invisible? And that's the main question for the book, and also that. Because this invisibility, and that's one of the main arguments of the book, contributed to the revival of a form of women's politics and a form of historical consciousness in Hungary after 1989, which actually led to this extremely successful illiberal turn what we are experiencing in Hungary today. So this the question of invisibility. So why these women are not visible? So first of all, because of the characteristic of women in politics. So usually the male leaders of the party politics are visible. Secondly, because this was an extremely heterogeneous group, maybe we might talk about this later on, and also because of the framework of the post-45 anti-fascist framework, which was mostly interested in pinning the responsibility for the war crime, for the war crimes in Hungary to a very well-defined group, and their women were not there. And also the different research attempts, the research on fascism, the research on perpetrators, and also feminist scholarship, they were, neither of them were very much interested in women till recently. And I haven't mentioned the problem of getting access to sources. So this is a...
Let's talk about that. Definitely. Yeah. Because I, you know, in establishing your source base, I mean, I want to come back to a lot of the topics that you just raised about the invisibilization, because each one of your chapters has the word invisible, party members, political actors, defendants, and photographs, and the heterogeneous nature of this Hungarist or far-right Hungarian movement turned into a party. But let's talk about those sources for a moment. So how do you make the invisible visible? What do you find? Where did you go? And what disappointments maybe did you face, or surprises did you have?
Yeah. Historian can only write history when there are sources. And also there are moments when you have to admit that there are no more sources. You cannot write more, right? So which also helps to, you know, finish a book project, which some of the authors are struggling with, but that helped me to finish this book project. But as I mentioned, it started from the different People's Tribunal court files. And these court People's Tribunal files are very specific sources, but that was the beginning. So I tried to establish who were those women who got on the radar of the new Hungarian legal system, who were those whom they asked to extradite from the Allied forces who escaped together with the German army to the West. And who were those who got to the different courts? And I tried to read as many files as possible and set up a kind of sociological survey about who actually got to these trials, which is, you know, immediately raises the question that who are those who did not have a trial, right?
Exactly.
Who did not have a trial, and then they are not, we don't have the documents. And this is one. But the other is that when you have those documents, what kind of source criticism do you have to apply to use those court files? And that's why there is this chapter about the invisible defendants, because this the gender politics of the People's Tribunals is pretty interesting, remarkable, and made certain perpetrators more visible than others.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, I'm a fan of your work for many years back because I also do biography. So when you're trying to get into the social history and biography and life story of these women, what techniques were you using? Because you're talking about a certain base of women who are then perpetrators but supporters of violence on the far right. So how did you actually get inside? Because you have so many names here. What was your approach?
My approach was, I mean, from the beginning, an extremely simple one. Try to collect the names of women from these People's Tribunals files. And I mean, I knew very few of them because I'm arguing in this book that half of the women who got to the People's Tribunals, they were ordinary housewives.
Right.
I mean, it's not me being uninformed, but that's a very different social group, and I just wanted to set up a kind of a list of those women who are who were defendants in the People's Court, and also there are some prominent cases, like prominent cases, either because of the crimes which were committed by women, or because the defendants were, you know, particularly famous or interesting, and. That was the beginning. And maybe that's the moment to talk a little bit about the perpetrator in the in the title, because this is a controversial term, because I'm actually using the terminology of the communist-dominated people's tribunals. But I'm consciously using this term, and I'm explaining also in the book that I got access to these files, and the women are represented in these files because of the communist legal process. Therefore, the perpetrator as a category is really important to understand their acts, their life stories, and the way how they were presenting themselves for the communist legal system. And also there is another political reason I'm consciously using this this term perpetrator, although during the even the review process, the reviewer whom I would like to express my gratitude also asked that am I sure that perpetrator should be in the title.
It's a fair question.
Because it's because it's so passé. But I'm politically insisting on having the perpetrator in this title, because there were crimes which these women actually committed. And what we experience today in the historiography, that there is this relativization of the crimes committed during the Second World War, with the argument that the People's Tribunals were a communist justice mord, a kind of unfair, non-transparent, ad hoc process. Therefore, these women and the other perpetrators were unfairly treated, and this was not a good and acceptable process. And this is the argument which is used by several conservative and illiberal regimes in Eastern Europe in order to somehow hide the fact that these citizens of Hungary committed serious crimes during the Second World War against fellow Hungarian citizens.
Yeah, and I want to follow up again on some of the moments in your book where you're discussing what the Germans call Täterforschung, right? This perpetrator research, because there seems to be a natural inclination to make the comparison in the history of fascism or fascism studies to Italy and Germany. But in taking your sample, you're actually working very much out of modern Hungarian history, and especially out of modern Hungarian gender history. So could you talk about the specific kind of Hungarian circumstances for these gender politics and gender values? What leads you, let's say, in doing both your primary and secondary research on these perpetrators, to frame it in the way you do, that is, to frame it in a way that's not naturally comparative to the normal comparisons that people sometimes make?
So there were several theoretical and methodological challenges when I was working on this book for 20 years.
Let's mention that too, Andrea.
So one of the challenges is that of course there is this big corpus on perpetrators in Germany, not that much in Italy, and this kind of research is somehow authoritative in a sense methodologically, theoretically, and also it sometimes takes away the attention that there were several perpetrators in these particular countries. And there is also another line of research which is only focusing on the national context. That ignores the transnational element of fascism and Nazism. So I try to, in the introduction, map out that what are the consequences of How does this particular situation contribute to the invisibilization, which is the key point in the book? And I also try to use other comparative material. But of course, you know, with the Ustasha movement, we are lucky because there are some books, or the Salo Republic, or of course the Iron Guard, we have got some, or the British Fascist Party. So there are some material, or the Falange. There are several books which somehow mention and look at the this question, mostly from the perspective of the party and the elite perspective, which means that this is mostly about men and very rarely about women's role in this movement, in the mobilization, and what role women played in the agenda of these different parties. So that's why I think this is pretty interesting to look at the kind of blind spots of the research. And that's what I call intersectional methodology. Of course, intersectionality is this big buzzword nowadays, and very often used as a descriptive category that this is intersectional. But I, what I'm trying to do is using intersectionality as a method, simply asking what is what we don't see and why don't we see that and why this should be there and it's not there and why do I think that it should be there and it's not there. So especially the chapter about the photographs, this was exactly born from this assumption that I looked at the photographs of the 1940s and women were just not there, neither before 44, neither after. So where were the women? Why is this representational deficit in the photographs? So that was my conscious methodological choice, mapping my and the blind spots of the literature.
Yeah, and I admire the way that you combine both the qualitative and quantitative element of this, because you're taking a small percentage of the legal files, right? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong about that, but how many files were there, and then how do you do this with the databases? Because there you say, I think correctly, that there are some deficiencies in the way even the archives set things up, right? Could you talk about that a little bit?
Right. So the People's Tribunal's files are not only problematic as an institution, right, that it was set up in a hurry and it is actually copy. It was actually copying the Soviet model of the justice system, but also the whole system was really flawed from the beginning. But it did not have any alternative. But the files of the People's Tribunals had been distributed between, in even in the case of Budapest, between the Budapest City Archive and the Historical Archive of the Secret Services. So what I was doing as a kind of off project of this, that together with Ildikó Barna, who is an associate professor at ELTE, we published a book about the political justice in Budapest between after the Second World War by CU Press, when we analyzed with quantitative methods these files. And actually, I'm very grateful for her help, and I learned a lot. She's a person of numbers. And we tried to quantify this 52,000 files which are available in the Budapest archive.
It's an incredible amount of work. I mean, I just don't know how many years it would take to do that. When did you start, may I ask, with her working on that?
I lost in this pandemic time. I'm lost my totally the sense of time. The book was published. I don't even remember when the book was published. First in Hungarian and then by the CU Press.
2005, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, but we got a big grant from the Rothschild Foundation, so we could get some help with research assistants who actually went to the archive and coded those files. And then we set up a database, and we could actually, because of the sampling method, where there is a whole chapter about sampling, which was written by me, I can tell you the secret, but by Yuliko Barna. The sampling, we could make very well-based statements about the social composition of the defendants, the crimes, the gender composition. So this is a pretty solid review of what actually has happened. And this is pretty paradox that somebody who is a feminist historian spent so much time in figuring out what has happened. But, you know, now there is a pretty solid book, which is based on numbers, explaining what has happened as far as the People's Tribunals are concerned. And again, I have a political agenda here. And the political agenda is that then you cannot speak nonsense about the People's Tribunals because we have the numbers, right? So it really, really makes it very difficult to instrumentalize this very complicated process for political purposes, because any moment I can just raise the book and say, read it.
And that, I think, empirical dimension of the research is absolutely essential, because otherwise in Orban's regime, we're just dealing with mythology. And, you know, what I really like in your technique is you get around not only this mythology, but also the essentialism. However, I do wonder if there is a certain ideal type, and this sounds like a Weberian question, but is there an ideal type of a woman in the Arrowcross party? Because you do describe it really, I think, in a fascinating way as a melting pot. So who are these women by name? What do you finally get when you go very, very deeply into the archives and do this kind of empirical research? Are there names and stories and people? Do they cross class lines? What are they about?
Mm-hmm. So the main paradox, which is so fascinating and which brought me to write this book already back in 2000, when I was sitting in the living room of the present day active Hungarian politically active women, was that how come certain women who actually has got extremely serious higher educational background and who actually voice certain social inequalities, they find their place not in the leftist movement, not in the trade union movement, but in a racist, exclusionist, anti-Semitic far-right movement. And in what sense this movement is being changed when these women are actually joining? And that's one of the interesting points, that there was this big debate in the Hungarian press about how feminist the Arrowcross Party was in 1941, because there were so many women joining to this party. So that's why we have to look at this variety of women who actually accepted this anti-modernist emancipation or this nationalist revolutionary way of emancipation. And who were these women? So, I mean, my research started from the People's Tribunals files, and then I looked at the press of this time, and then I looked at the remaining material of the Arrowcross Party, which is pretty interesting that very few documents remained, and they are also scattered in different archives. And because when the Arrowcross had to leave the country because of the approaching Red Army, they took most of their files with them. And these files now in München, in the Institut für Zeitgeschichte, in the archive. Okay. And we have a fabulous book based on that archive by Margit Szőlősi-Janze, but there is not a single woman in that book. And if you look at the inventory of the archive, it's pretty obvious why there are no women. Because when they put all their material on trucks the autumn of 1944, they obviously selected the so-called important files. And the material of the women's section was not particularly important for those who actually packed these vans. So, and that's why it's so interesting that when and how material from the party remained. And that's when the Trianon Peace Treaty comes into the picture, because the Arrow Cross Party was very active in those territories which were cut from Hungary after the lost First World War. And that's why I found the only photograph about these Arrow Cross women in uniform in Košice, in Kosha, in Slovakia. And totally surprisingly, the Novi Sad, Ujvidek in Serbia territory, in the archive, the whole material of the Arrow Cross section is available, which means, and then based on that files, I could reconstruct the party inner life and what were the conflicts inside the party, how the women were struggling for their own space in the party, and how actually the party was transformed because so many women joined the party with these anti-modernist revolutionary ideas. And of course, as every party life, I'm sorry to say, is pretty boring and formalized, this party was not an exception either. So you have got the letters of the different party members complaining about that they are bored with taking care of the corner of the heroes in the party room. And I mean, but these are all very interesting, that women joined in order to make politics, to make difference, to make the world more equal. And what they found is that they were expected to do so-called social work and visit the young mothers with small children and taking care of the orphans. And they were not necessarily happy with that assigned role. So that's why I said that the Arrow Cross Party itself has changed because so many women. So let's speak about numbers, right?
Yeah.
What is this so many? What is this so many? Definitely, if you look at the numbers of the women in the on the list who were defendants, we see that approximately 10% of those who were convicted, they were women. And this is a pretty high percentage, because if we look at the numbers nowadays, in the Hungarian parliament, it's only 10% who are women. And also in the general kind of criminal inventory, the number of women who got into the criminal system increased only in the 1970s from 5% to nowadays 30%. So this 10% who actually joined the Arrow Cross Party, at a certain point there were district branches where 30% of the members were women. So, I mean, it was really dependent on the particular district, but we are talking about large numbers.
Yeah, I do want to take us out of the 1930s and 1940s into the 1970s and finally up to the present. But my favorite chapter in your book is the chapter on photographs. And I know that you had mentioned this before. What kind of visual truth is in photographs and what's not there? I think about the work of Marianne Hirsch and others, Carl Zemel, whose work you mention. I really would like to ask you how you interpret these photographs, because you get around the trope of the photographs depicting the women as wives and mothers and far right in a subordinate or kind of supplementary role. How do you end up restoring their agency and their action and ultimately through the photographs establishing their networks of perpetration?
This chapter was born because I was asking the question, how did these women look like? I mean, there is no way that I would, I want to visual, I want to see their eyes, right? I want to see them. Mm-hmm. How do they look like? And interestingly enough, I haven't found any photographs in these hundreds of files of the People's Tribunals I went through. And that is already a finding, that the People's Tribunals did not use photograph as a proof. And then I was wondering where the heck I can find photographs. And then I started to scan the different photo archives. And and there is
Fortepan, right?
Did you look? Fortepan, yes. And also the Museum of Photography and also the National Archive of the Hungarian National Museum. So, and then I was wondering, why don't I find them? Where are they, right? And where they could have been. And then I started to look at the different miscellaneous boxes, and that's where I found them. And that's where I found the most astonishing photograph, I think, which is about the execution of a woman and who was a war criminal and whose name is Monty, which is a kind of diminutive for Margaret. But none of the women who were executed for the as a war criminal has a name Margaret. So obviously the person who was cataloging this photograph did not, you know, invest any energy to figure out who this person was on that photograph. So that's why we have got a pretty astonishing photograph also published in this volume without, you know, figuring out who is this woman whom we see a couple of minutes before the execution. And I also tried the different new private archives. So I tried the the digital archive of the Whisperer. And Whisperer was a website which was actually run from a U.S. server, and that was a neo-Nazi website which had a section that our former heroes, I think that was the subsection, and then they encouraged the visitors to upload their family photographs. And that's one of the reasons why I was not finding these photos, because the iconoclasm, right? Because between 1945 and 1989, having a photo of your grandmother smiling together with the head of the Aerocross party was not the surest ticket to the prison. So, so that's why these photos actually emerged after 89 when they were revising the anti-fascist framework. I registered on this Whisperer under pen name, which is, of course, raising several issues on research ethics. And then I started to monitor what kind of photos are actually being uploaded there. And lots of interesting photographs about the women who were employees in the Aerocross party were up there. And then I tried to get a permit from the administrator to publish it, but never responded. And then came the change in the legislation against hate crimes. And then this webpage was discontinued, and now it's available only on the dark web. And that's where this is a limit, right?
I'm asking you to tell us all of your secrets. Our listeners want to know. I mean, I'm much more of an amateur. I end up on genealogy websites and looking for information that way sometimes, because it really is a taboo, and there are so many taboos that still exist in doing research to make the perpetrators come to terms with justice and anti-Semitism and the Holocaust and everything. So I mean, you know, we're still talking about a country and a city after 1944 in which you have 600,000 Jews executed. And we're still talking about a country where much more research, I think, on this topic remains to be done. So I'm going to ask you the next question really about the fabric of memory in Hungarian society. So obviously in the past 10 years or maybe 20 years, there have been these changes in the legislation, but What would you hope for research on this topic in Hungary and in the context of illiberal democracy and illiberalism today?
I mean, this is a very serious question, and we were laughing before that. So, I mean, the problem is that this is a very serious question that how there in the past 10 years there was an enormous investment by the liberal government setting up parallel historical research institutions. And there hasn't been in the history of Hungarian historiography so much money channeled into historical research. And but the way how this has been done without any transparency, without any quality control, without any reference to the international research actually makes this efforts extremely dubious. And because of the CEU had to go to exile, and because of the nationalization of the different universities now, lots of colleagues are actually applying self-censorship, and direct or indirect censorship, and the whole structure of the Hungarian historiography has been changed. Because getting funding from outside is not only impossible because of the institutional framework, but also makes you, a target of different attacks and dubious. While, on the other hand, the internal sources and internal funding is abundant. Abundant and easy for those who are loyal to the government. So, and the topic I'm researching, this invisibility, is really a topic which is not on high priority by the liberal government, because this is one of the taboos of the illiberal memory politics, namely the collaboration and the Hungarian perpetrators. And because some of the listeners might follow the erecting of the monument of the German occupation, the victims of the German occupation at a prominent spot in Budapest, the capital of Hungary, which was erected during night, without any kind of discussion. And this monument is basically based on the assumption that Hungary had been always a victim of different occupations, starting with the German, followed by the Soviet occupation, which is not new, because after 1989, in the former communist countries, this double occupation, the theory of double occupation, was used first to set up anti-communism as a main framework, secondly, to avoid any kind of facing responsibility for the collaboration with the Soviets and with the Germans. So this issue of the Hungarian collaboration is really a tabooized and difficult topic.
And could you talk a little bit about where your work places in gender history, and especially in let's say social history as well? So in terms of the historiography, what are you imagining for future research, not just on the Arrowcross Party, but on the history of, let's say, global far right movements and fascism or neoliberal neo-patriarchy, as one person has called it? What do you see, let's say, in research going forward from your book?
When I was mapping why these women are invisible, one of the reasons is the different topics and tendencies in feminist historiography, because feminist historiography mostly likes to see women as agents of positive change and a kind of a positive story. I mean, this story is not really a good story. It's a disturbing story. It's a challenging story. And the story which actually forces us to re-examine the different orthodoxies which are really present in gender history writing. And but in Germany, there had been several research book several books had been published on the perpetrators of the guards of the different concentration camps and the prominent women like the wives, like the Eva Braun story. And the social history research is already starting about the medical stuff, about female doctors. And I also find this really, really important that now we are getting to this extremely time-consuming and very difficult period when we are doing this diving into the in the sources and trying to get into this, to understand the different structures and opportunities, why so many female doctors actually joined the Aerocross Party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you think that the joining, this is a smaller question, maybe it could be a larger question, but the joining into parties like the Aerocross Party is a moment of liberation? You use the word emancipation. I found that interesting before, and I want to kind of hold you to that, because the question about emancipation or liberation through far right movements might strike people as absolutely oxymoronic. I mean, why people would make that, especially why women, but why anyone would make that choice. So I find that one of the great paradoxes in your book. Could you explain this emancipatory moment where women become involved in movements like this?
I'm using the concept of anti-modernist emancipation. And we have to see this particular social context where several women actually could not... should reject the so-called conservative offer. The conservative offer of the interwar times is that you are, you know, studying something and then you get married and then your husband is earning enough money and you are staying home, have children, and then you live happily after. And this kind of conservative women's politics was basically out of reach for so many women because of structural reasons, because they were single and they have to earn their living. And for them, this kind of women's politics was not really acceptable because it did not meet their everyday lived experiences. So these women were looking for alternatives. And for them, the Communist Party, the Social Democratic Party, and the trade union, they were not really an option, an opportunity, not to speak about how sexist the trade union movement was, I mean, in brackets. But yes. because of the interwar move, interwar Hungary was very much informed by the anti-communism and the anti-leftist sentiments, because that was the main framework, blaming the social democrats and the communists for the loss of the First World War and because of the loss of the two-thirds of the Hungarian territory. So in that particular framework, lots of women who joined the Aerocross Party, they were refugees from these territories, from the Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Yugoslavia to Hungary, and they were radically opposing the leftist alternative. Still, they have an experience in the employment. And that's why it is so important to stress that the first draft bill against sexual harassment in the workplace was submitted by the Aerocross Party in Hungary in 1938. And this, of course, was submitted in the framework that the Jewish international capitalists are misusing the innocent Hungarian women who had to do some work. Still, that was the first.
That's stunning. That's stunning. Really, I mean, that argument. Go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
But that's the. But they received support and help. And from the 1930s, Hungary is getting impoverished. The social welfare structure is disappearing. And there was only one party which was offering a kind of security and support. And that was the radical far-right anti-Semitic offer of the Arrow Cross Party. So that's why it's, as Walter Benjamin said, always the failure of the leftist social democratic alternative when women, when people are turning to the far right. That was also the case because there were several grievances to which the Arrow Cross Party had an answer. This answer was as a kind of a racist, anti-Semitic answer, but it was an answer which met the demand of so many women.
That is so fascinating. I mean, honestly, I would hope that liberal feminists and progressives take note of this, and really in the jump into the 2010s, that this idea of the far rightist welfare state that's offered only to some. Right. But when it is offered to some, maybe it seems effective. I don't know. That's just striking to me. I would really like to ask you, since we're winding down and we'll be running out of time, what your current research is about. You mentioned a lot of projects and your activism. Could you talk to our listeners about everything that you're involved in? You're involved in so many different things right now.
I would like to mention two projects very briefly. One is my new book, which is coming out in spring by the De Gruyters, which is a history of a massacre which happened on the 15th of October, 1944. And I plan to write this book as a crime story. So this is, I hope, a book that you start from the cover to the end and read it and you don't want to stop it. And this book is interesting because the perpetrator is a woman. So I found this file when I was doing this a big project on the People's Tribunal's files, and I found this woman who was hanged because allegedly she was the perpetrator of this massacre, which left 18 people dead in the center of Budapest. And this is the story which is coming out, and I interviewed the survivors, I interviewed the perpetrators, I interviewed those who participated in the justice process. Again, you can write history when there are sources. And luckily, this story has got lots of sources, so I'm analyzing these sources. And the other project I'm very much involved, I already mentioned the extremely dubious memorialization strategies of the liberal government, is the erecting a memorial Budapest for the victims of wartime sexual violence. And maybe the listeners know that in the recent municipal election, Budapest was won by the opposition. And interestingly, in this January, the Budapest municipal made a bipartisan decision. It means that the opposition and the present ruling leftist liberal politicians agreed on setting up this memorial after a long process of discussion. And this is a transparent process based on dialogue. And we started a series of lectures in the Budapest City Archive. There is a collection of personal stories. There will be international conferences. Everything is available on the website of this project, which is www.elhallgatva.hu. It has got an English version as well, and ELGALLGATVA, elhallgatva.ho. And this in this website, what we are trying to do is to make this as a flagship project, open a space for discussion, and hopefully we will have the international open call for memorials next spring, and then there will be an exhibition of the submitted pieces, and for 2023, hopefully we will have a memorial place which will put Budapest on the site of the interesting memorials or the cities where you have got interesting memorials.
That's amazing. I mean, I would also hope that there would be visual work done with all the photographs that you've collected. Have you thought about this too, for both for your book and for the other projects?
about the sexual violence, you mean?
Yes, during
wartime. Yeah. So I wrote the book about the history of sexual violence during the Second World War, which is coming out in German by the Wallstein Verlag in the spring next year again. And then there is a chapter about the visual representation of sexual violence during wartime. They're basically analyzing the taboo and also the limits, what you can do and what you cannot do with atrocity photographs. And when you have got naked women's bodies photographs, what can you do and what you cannot do? But that will be in German.
Okay. Well, we are now seriously out of time. So I want to say kusunam sepen and thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much. This was an honor. Thank you.
Thanks to our listeners. I'm Steven Siegel. I'm your host here at New Books Network, and we've been featuring Professor Andrea Pietto, who is the author of a new book. The book is called The Women of the Arrow Cross Party, Invisible Hungarian Perpetrators in the Second World War, published by Palgrave in 2020. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.